Yes, a little kindness. Everyone deserves that much, however big or small. He looked about for his wine cup, but when he found it, all the rum had spilled. Drowning is bad enough, he reflected sourly, but drowning sad and sober, that's too cruel. In the end they did not drown, though there were times when the prospect of a nice, peaceful drowning had a certain appeal. The storm raged for the rest of that day and well into the night. Wet winds howled around them, and waves rose up like the fists of drowned giants to smash down on their decks. Above, they learned later, a mate and two sailors were swept overboard. The ship's cook was blinded when a kettle of hot grease flew up into his face, and the captain was thrown from the stern castle to the main deck so violently he broke both legs. Below, Crunch howled and barked and snapped at Penny, and Pretty Pig began to shit again, turning the cramped, damp cabin into a sty. Tyrion managed to avoid retching his way through all of this, chiefly thanks to the lack of wine. Penny was not so fortunate, but he held her anyway as the ship's hull creaked and groaned alarmingly around them, like a cask about to burst. Near by midnight, the winds finally died away, and the sea grew calm enough for Tyrion to make his way back up onto deck. What he saw there did not reassure him. The cog was drifting on a sea of dragonglass beneath a bowl of stars, but all around the storm raged on. East, west, north, south, everywhere he looked, the clouds rose up like black mountains, their tumbled slopes and colossal cliffs alive with blue and purple lightning. No rain was falling, but the decks were slick and wet underfoot. Tyrion could hear someone screaming from below, a thin, high voice hysterical with fear. He could hear Makoro, too. The Red Priest stood on the forecastle facing the storm, his staff raised above his head as he boomed a prayer. Amidships, a dozen sailors and two of the fiery fingers were struggling with tangled lines and sodden canvas. But whether they were trying to raise the sail again or pull it down, he never knew. Whatever they were doing, it seemed to him a very bad idea. And so it was. The wind returned as a whispered threat, cold and damp, brushing over his cheek, flapping the wet sail, swirling and tugging at Makaro's scarlet robes. Some instinct made Tyrion grab hold of the nearest rail just in time. In the space of three heartbeats, the little breeze became a howling gale. Makaro shouted something, and green flames leapt from the dragon's maw atop his staff to vanish in the night. Then the rains came, black and blinding, and forecastle and stern castle both vanished behind a wall of water. Something huge flapped overhead, and Tyrion glanced up in time to see the sail taking wing, with two men still dangling from the lines. Then he heard a crack. Oh, bloody hell! He had time to think. That had to be the mast. He found a line and pulled on it, fighting towards the hatch to get himself below out of the storm. But a gust of wind knocked his feet from under him, and a second slammed him into the rail, and there he clung. Rain lashed at his face, blinding him. His mouth was full of blood again. The ship groaned and growled beneath him, like a constipated fat man straining to shit. Then the mast burst. Tyrion never saw it, but he heard it. That cracking sound again, and then a scream of tortured wood, and suddenly the air was full of shards and splinters. One missed his eye by half an inch, a second found his neck, a third went through his calf, boots and breeches and all. He screamed, but he held on to the line, held on with a desperate strength he did not know he had. But the widow said the ship would never reach her destination, he remembered. Then he laughed and laughed, wild and hysterical, as thunder boomed and timbers moaned and waves crashed all around him. By the time the storm abated, and the surviving passengers and crew came crawling back on deck, like pale pink worms wriggling to the surface after a rain, the Selasaurikoran was a broken thing, floating low in the water and listing 10 degrees to port, her hull sprung in 50 places, her hold awash in seawater, her mast a splintered ruin no taller than a dwarf. Even her figurehead had not escaped. One of his arms had broken off, the one with all his scrolls. 9 men had been lost, including a mate, 2 of the Fiery Fingers, and Macaro himself. "Did Benero see this in his fires?" Tyrion wondered, when he realized that huge red priest was gone. "Did Macaro?" "Prophecy is like a half-trained mule," he complained to Jorah Mormont. "It looks as though it might be useful, but the moment you trust in it, it kicks you in the head. That bloody widow knew the ship would never reach her destination. She warned us of that. Said Benero saw it in his fires. And I took that to mean, well, what does it matter?" His mouth twisted. What it really meant was that some bloody big storm would turn our mast to kindling, so that we could drift aimlessly across the gulf of grief, until our food ran out and we started eating one another. Who do you suppose they'll carve up first, the pig, the dog, or me? The noisiest, I'd say. The captain died the following day. The ship's cook 3 nights later. It was all that the remaining crew could do to keep the wreck afloat. The mate, who had assumed command, reckoned they were somewhere off the southern end of the Isle of Cedars. When he lowered the ship's boats to tow them toward the nearest land, one sank, and the men in the other cut the line and rowed off north, abandoning the cog and all their shipmates. "Slaves," said Jorah Mormont, contemptuous. The big knight had slept through the storm, to hear him tell it. Tyrion had his doubts, but he kept them to himself. One day he might want to bite someone in the leg, and for that you needed teeth. Mormont seemed content to ignore their disagreement, so Tyrion decided to pretend it had not happened. For 19 days they drifted, as food and water dwindled. The sun beat down on them, relentless. Penny huddled in her cabin with her dog and her pig, and Tyrion brought her food, limping on his bandaged calf and sniffing at the wound by night. When he had nothing else to do, he pricked his toes and fingers too. Sir Jorah made a point of sharpening his sword each day, honing the point until it gleamed. The 3 remaining Fiery Fingers lit the night fire as the sun went down, but they wore their ornate armor as they led the crew in prayer, and the spears were close at hand. And not a single sailor tried to rub the head of either dwarf.
"Should we joust for them again?" Penny asked one night.
"Best not," said Tyrion. "That would only serve to remind them we have a nice plump pig." Though Pretty was growing less plump with every passing day, and Crunch was fur and bones. That night he dreamed that he was back in King's Landing again, a crossbow in his hand. "Wherever oars go," Lord Tywin said. But when Tyrion's finger clenched and the bowstring thrummed, it was Penny with a quarrel buried in her belly. He woke to the sound of shouting. The deck was moving under him, and for 50 he was so confused he thought he was back on the Shy Maid. A whiff of pig shit brought him to his senses. The sorrows were behind him, 50 away, and the joys of that time as well. He remembered how sweet L'Amour had looked after her morning swims, with beads of water glistening on her naked skin. But the only maiden here was his poor Penny, the stunted little dwarf girl. Something was afoot, though.
Tyrion slipped from his hammock, yawning, and looked about for his boots. And mad though it was, he looked for the crossbow as well. But, of course, there was none such to be found. "A pity," he mused. "It might have been some use when the big folk come to eat me." He pulled his boots on and climbed up on deck to see what the shouting was about. Penny was there before him, her eyes wide with wonder.
"A sail!" she shouted. "There, there, do you see? A sail! And they've seen us! They have! A sail!"
This time he kissed her, once on each cheek, once on the brow, and one last one on the mouth. She was flushed and laughing by the last kiss, suddenly shy again, but it made no matter. The other ship was closing, a big galley he saw. Her oars left a long white wake behind her. "What ship is that?" he asked Sir Jorah Mormont. "Can you read her name?"
"I don't need to read her name. We're downwind. I can smell her."
Mormont drew his sword.
"That's a slaver."
The Turncloak. The first flakes came drifting down as the sun was setting in the west. By nightfall, snow was coming down so heavily that the moon rose behind a white curtain unseen.
"The gods of the north have unleashed their wrath on Lord Stannis," Roose Bolton announced come morning, as men gathered in Winterfell's great hall to break their fast. "He is a stranger here, and the old gods will not suffer him to live."
His men roared their approval, banging their fists on the long plank tables. Winterfell might be ruined, but its granite walls would still keep the worst of the wind and weather at bay. They were well stocked with food and drink. They had fires to warm them when off duty, a place to dry their clothes, snug corners to lie down and sleep. Lord Bolton had laid by enough wood to keep the fires fed for half a year, so the great hall was always warm and cozy. Stannis had none of that. Theon Greyjoy did not join the uproar. Neither did the men of House Frey, he did not fail to note. "They are strangers here as well," he thought, watching Sir Aenys Frey and his half-brother Sir Hustine. Born and bred in the Riverlands, the Freys had never seen a snow like this. "The North has already claimed three of their blood," Theon thought, recalling the men that Ramsay had searched for fruitlessly, lost between White Harbour and Barrington. On the dais, Lord Wyman Manderly sat between a pair of his White Harbour knights, spooning porridge into his fat face. He did not seem to be enjoying it near as much as he had the pork pies at the wedding. Elsewhere, one-armed Harwood Stout talked quietly with a cadaverous horsebane umber. Theon queued up with the other men for porridge, ladled into wooden bowls from a row of copper kettles. The lords and knights had milk and honey and even a bit of butter to sweeten their portions, he saw, but none of that would be offered him. His reign as Prince of Winterfell had been a brief one. He had played his part in the Mummer's show, giving the feigned Arya to be wed, and he was of no further use to Roose Bolton.
"First winter I remember, the snows came over my head," said a Hornwood man in the queue ahead of him.
"Aye, but you were only 3 foot tall at the time," a rider from the Rills replied. Last night, unable to sleep, Theon had found himself brooding on escape, of slipping away unseen, whilst Ramsay and his lord father had their attention elsewhere. Every gate was closed and barred, and heavily guarded, though. No one was allowed to enter or depart the castle without Lord Bolton's leave. Even if he found some secret way out, Theon would not have trusted it. He had not forgotten Kyra and her keys. And if he did get out, where would he go? His father was dead, and his uncles had no use for him. Pike was lost to him. The nearest thing to a home that remained to him was here, amongst the bones of Winterfell.
A ruined man. A ruined castle. This is my place.
He was still waiting for his porridge when Ramsay swept into the hall with his bastard's boys, shouting for music. Abel rubbed the sleep from his eyes, took up his lute, and launched into the Dornishman's wife, whilst one of his washerwomen beat time on her drum. His singer changed the words, though. Instead of tasting a Dornishman's wife, he sang of tasting a Northman's daughter.
"He could lose his tongue for that," Theon thought, as his bowl was being filled. "He is only a singer. Lord Ramsay could flay the skin off both his hands, and no one would say a word."
But Lord Bolton smiled at the lyric, and Ramsay laughed aloud. Then others knew that it was safe to laugh as well. Yellow Dick found the song so funny that wine snorted out of his nose. Lady Arya was not there to share the merriment. She had not been seen outside her chambers since her wedding night. Sir Alan had been saying that Ramsay kept his bride naked and chained to a bedpost, but Theon knew that was only talk. There were no chains, at least none that men could see, just a pair of guards outside the bedchamber to keep the girl from wandering.
"And she is only naked when she bathes."
That she did most every night, though. Lord Ramsay wanted his wife clean.
"She has no handmaids, poor thing," he had said to Theon. "That leaves you, Reek. Should I put you in a dress?" He laughed. "Perhaps if you beg it of me. Just now it will suffice you to be her bathmaid. I won't have her smelling like you."
So whenever Ramsay had an itch to bed his wife, it fell to Theon to borrow some serving women from Lady Walder or Lady Dustin and fetch hot water from the kitchens. Though Arya never spoke to any of them, they could not fail to see her bruises.
"It's her own fault. She has not pleased him."
"Just be Arya," he told the girl once, as he helped her into the water. "Lord Ramsay does not want to hurt you. He only hurts us when we forget. He never cut me without cause." "Theon," she whispered, weeping.
"Reek."
He grabbed her arm and shook her.
"In here, I'm Reek. You have to remember, Arya."
But the girl was no true Stark, only a Stuart's whelp.
"Jane. Her name is Jane. She should not look to me for rescue."
Theon Greyjoy might have tried to help her once, but Theon had been ironborn and a braver man than Reek.
"Reek, Reek, it rhymes with weak."
Ramsay had a new plaything to amuse him, one with teats and a cunny. But soon Jane's tears would lose their savour, and Ramsay would want his Reek again.
"He will flay me inch by inch. When my fingers are gone, he will take my hands. After, my toes. My feet. But only when I beg for it, when the pain grows so bad that I plead for him to give me some relief."
There would be no hot baths for Reek. He would roll in shit again, forbidden to wash. The clothes he wore would turn to rags, foul and stinking, and he would be made to wear them until they rotted. The best he could hope for was to be returned to the kennels with Ramsay's girls for company.
"Kyra," he remembered, "the new bitch he calls Kyra."
He took his bowl to the back of the hall and found a place on an empty bench yards away from the nearest torch. Day or night, the benches down below the sort were never less than half full, with men drinking, dicing, talking, or sleeping in their clothes in quiet corners. Their sergeants would kick them awake when it came their turn to shrug back into their cloaks and walk the walls. But no man of them would welcome the company of Theon Turncloak, nor did he have much taste for theirs. The gruel was grey and watery, and he pushed it away after his third spoonful and let it congeal in the bowl. At the next table, men were arguing about the storm and wondering aloud how long the snow would fall.
All day and all night, might be even longer, insisted one big, black-bearded archer with a Serwyn axe sewn on his breast. A few of the older men spoke of other snowstorms and insisted this was no more than a light dusting compared to what they'd seen in the winters of their youth. The Riverlanders were aghast.
They have no love of snow and cold, these Southron swords.
Men entering the hall huddled by the fires or clapped their hands together over glowing braziers as their cloaks hung dripping from pegs inside the door. The air was thick and smoky, and a crust had formed atop his porridge, when a woman's voice behind him said,
"Theon Greyjoy."
"My name is Reek," he almost said. "What do you want?" She sat down next to him, straddling the bench, and pushed a wild mop of red-brown hair out of her eyes.
"Why do ye eat alone, my lord? Come, rise, join the dance."
He went back to his porridge. "I don't dance." The Prince of Winterfell had been a graceful dancer, but Reek, with his missing toes, would be grotesque.
"Leave me be. I have no coin."
The woman smiled crookedly.
"D'ye take me for a whore?"
She was one of the singer's washerwomen, the tall, skinny one, too lean and leathery to be called pretty, though there was a time when Theon would have tumbled her all the same, to see how it felt to have those long legs wrapped around him.
"What good would coin do me here? What would I buy with it, some snow?" she laughed. "You could pay me with a smile. I've never seen you smile, not even during your sister's wedding feast." "Lady Arya is not my sister."
"I do not smile either," he might have told her.
"Ramsay hated my smile, so he took a hammer to my teeth. I can hardly eat. She never was my sister."
"A pretty maid, though."
"I was never beautiful like Sansa, but they all said I was pretty."
Jane's words seemed to echo in his head, to the beat of the drums two of Abel's other girls were pounding. Another one had pulled little Walder Frey up onto the table to teach him how to dance. All the men were laughing.
"Leave me be," said Theon. "Am I not to my lord's taste? I could send Myrtle to you, if you want, or Holly. Might be you like her better. All the men like Holly. They're not my sisters, neither, but they're sweet."
The woman leaned close. Her breath smelled of wine.
"If you have no smile for me, tell me how you captured Winterfell. Abel will put it in a song, and you will live forever. As a betrayer, as Theon Turncloak." "Why not Theon the Clever? It was a daring feat, the way we heard it. How many men did you have? 100? 50?
"Fewer. It was madness."
"Glorious madness. Stannis has 5,000, they say, but Abel claims 10 times as many still could not breach these walls. So how did you get in, my lord? Did you have some secret way?"
"I had ropes," Theon thought. "I had grapnels. I had darkness on my side, and surprise. The castle was but lightly held, and I took them unawares." But he said none of that. If Abel made a song about him, like as not, Ramsay would prick his eardrums to make certain that he never heard it.
"You can trust me, my lord. Abel does."
The washerwoman put her hand upon his own. His hands were gloved in wool and leather. Hers were bare, long-fingered, rough, with nails chewed to the quick.
"You never asked my name. It's Rowan."
Theon wrenched away. This was a ploy, he knew it.
"Ramsay sent her. She's another of his japes. Like Kyra with the keys. A jolly jape, that's all. He wants me to run so he can punish me."
He wanted to hit her, to smash that mocking smile off her face. He wanted to kiss her, to fuck her right there on the table and make her cry his name. But he knew he dare not touch her, in anger or in lust.
"Reek,
Weak, my name is Weak. I must not forget my name. He jerked to his feet and made his way wordlessly to the doors, limping on his maimed feet. Outside, the snow was falling still. Wet, heavy, silent, it had already begun to cover the footsteps left by the men coming and going from the hall. The drifts came almost to the top of his boots. It would be deeper in the Wolf's Wood, and out on the King's Road, where the wind is blowing, there will be no escape from it. A battle was being fought in the yard. Riseworth's pelting Barreton boys with snowballs. Above, he could see some squires building snowmen along the battlements. They were arming them with spears and shields, putting iron half-helms on their heads, and arraying them along the inner wall, a rank of snowy sentinels. "Lord Winter has joined us with his levies," one of the sentries outside the great hall japed, until he saw Theon's face and realized who he was talking to. Then he turned his head and spat. Beyond the tents, the big destriers of the knights from White Harbour and the twins were shivering in their horse lines. Ramsay had burned the stables when he sacked Winterfell, so his father had thrown up new ones, twice as large as the old, to accommodate the war horses and palfreys of his lords, bannermen, and knights. The rest of the horses were tethered in the wards. Hooded grooms moved amongst them, covering them with blankets to keep them warm. Theon made his way deeper into the ruined parts of the castle. As he picked through the shattered stone that had once been Maester Lewin's turret, ravens looked down from the gash in the wall above, muttering to one another. From time to time one would let out a raucous scream. He stood in the doorway of a bedchamber that had once been his own, ankle-deep in snow that had blown in through a shattered window, visited the ruins of Mickon's Forge and Lady Caitlin's Sept. Beneath a burned tower he passed Rickard Riseworth, nuzzling at the neck of another one of Abel's washerwomen, the plump one with the apple cheeks and pug nose. The girl was barefoot in the snow, bundled up in a fur cloak. He thought she might be naked underneath. When she saw him, she said something to Riseworth that made him laugh aloud. Theon trudged away from them. There was a stair beyond the mews, seldom used. It was there his feet took him. The steps were steep and treacherous. He climbed carefully and found himself alone on the battlements of the inner wall, well away from the squires and their snowmen. No one had given him freedom of the castle, but no one had denied it to him either. He could go where he would within the walls. Winterfell's inner wall was the older and taller of the two, its ancient grey crenellations rising 100 feet high, with square towers at every corner. The outer wall, raised many centuries later, was 20 feet lower, but thicker and in better repair, boasting octagonal towers in place of square ones. Between the two walls was the moat, deep and wide and frozen. Drifts of snow had begun to creep across its icy surface. Snow was building up along the battlements too, filling the gaps between the merlons and putting pale soft caps on every tower top. Beyond the walls, as far as he could see, the world was turning white. The woods, the fields, the King's Road, the snows were covering all of them beneath a pale soft mantle, burying the remnants of the winter town, hiding the blackened walls Ramsay's men had left behind when they put the houses to the torch. "The wounds, snow made, snow conceals." But that was wrong. Ramsay was a Bolton now, not a snow, never a snow. Farther off, the rutted King's Road had vanished, lost amidst the fields and rolling hills, all one vast expanse of white. And still the snow was falling, drifting down in silence from a windless sky. "Stannis Baratheon is out there somewhere," freezing. Would Lord Stannis try and take Winterfell by storm? If he does, his cause is doomed. The castle was too strong. Even with the moat frozen over, Winterfell's defences remained formidable. Theon had captured the castle by stealth, sending his best men to scale the walls and swim the moat under the cover of darkness. The defenders had not even known they were under attack until it was too late. No such subterfuge was possible for Stannis. He might prefer to cut the castle off from the outside world and starve out its defenders. Winterfell's storerooms and cellar vaults were empty. A long supply train had come with Bolton and his friends of Frey up through the Neck. Lady Dustin had brought food and fodder from Barrowton, and Lord Manderley had arrived well-provisioned from White Harbour. But the host was large. With so many mouths to feed, their stores could not last for long.
Lord Stannis and his men will be just as hungry, though, and cold and footsore as well, in no condition for a fight. But the storm will make them desperate to get inside the castle.
Snow was falling on the Godswood too, melting when it touched the ground. Beneath the white-cloaked trees, the earth had turned to mud. Tendrils of mist hung in the air like ghostly ribbons.
"Why did I come here? These are not my gods. This is not my place."
The heart tree stood before him, a pale giant with a carved face and leaves like bloody hands. A thin film of ice covered the surface of the pool beneath the weirwood. Theon sank to his knees beside it.
"Please," he murmured through his broken teeth. "I never meant..." The words caught in his throat. "Save me," he finally managed. "Give me... what? Strength? Courage? Mercy?"
Snow fell around him, pale and silent, keeping its own counsel. The only sound was a faint, soft sobbing.
"Jane," he thought, "it is her, sobbing in her bridal bed. Who else could it be?"
"Gods do not weep."
"Or do they?"
The sound was too painful to endure. Theon grabbed hold of a branch and pulled himself back to his feet, knocked the snow off his legs, and limped back toward the lights.
"There are ghosts in Winterfell," he thought, "and I am one of them."
More snowmen had risen in the yard by the time Theon Greyjoy made his way back. To command the snowy sentinels on the walls, the squires had erected a dozen snowy lords. One was plainly meant to be Lord Manderley. It was the fattest snowman that Theon had ever seen. The one-armed lord could only be Harwood Stout, the snow lady, Barbary Dustin, and the one closest the door, with a beard made of icicles, had to be old Horsebane Umber. Inside, the cooks were ladling out beef and barley stew, thick with carrots and onions, served in trenchers hollowed from loaves of yesterday's bread. Scraps were thrown onto the floor to be gobbled up by Ramsay's girls and the other dogs. The girls were glad to see him. They knew him by his smell. Red Jane loped over to lick at his hand, and Helisant slipped under the table and curled up by his feet, gnawing at a bone. They were good dogs. It was easy to forget that every one was named for a girl that Ramsay had hunted and killed. Weary as he was, Theon had appetite enough to eat a little stew, washed down with ale. By then the hall had grown raucous. Two of Roose Bolton's scouts had come straggling back through the hunter's gate to report that Lord Stannis's advance had slowed to a crawl. His knights rode destriers, and the big war horses were floundering in the snow. The small, sure-footed garrons of the hill clans were faring better, the scouts said, but the clansmen dared not press too far ahead, or the whole host would come apart. Lord Ramsay commanded Abel to give them a marching song in honour of Stannis, trudging through the snows. So the bard took up his lute again, whilst one of his washerwomen coaxed the sword from Sir Alan, and Mime Stannis slashing at the snowflakes. Theon was staring down into the last dregs of his third tankard when Lady Barbary Dustin swept into the hall and sent two of her sworn swords to bring him to her. When he stood below the dais, she looked him up and down and sniffed.
"Those are the same clothes you wore for the wedding."
"Yes, my lady. They are the clothes I was given." That was one of the lessons he had learned at the Dreadfort, to take what he was given and never ask for more. Lady Dustin wore black as ever, though her sleeves were lined with vair. Her gown had a high stiff colour that framed her face.
"You know this castle?"
"Once."
"Somewhere beneath us are the crypts where the old Stark kings sit in darkness. My men have not been able to find the way down into them. They have been through all the undercrofts and cellars, even the dungeons, but the crypts cannot be accessed from the dungeons, milady. Can you show me the way down?"
"There's nothing down there but
dead Starks, aye. And all my favourite Starks are dead, as it happens. Do you know the way or not?"
"I do." He did not like the crypts, had never liked the crypts, but he was no stranger to them.
"Show me. Sergeant, fetch a lantern."
"My lady will want a warm cloak," cautioned Theon. "We will need to go outside." The snow was coming down heavier than ever when they left the hall, with Lady Dustin wrapped in sable. Huddled in their hooded cloaks, the guards outside were almost indistinguishable from the snowmen. Only their breath fogging the air gave proof that they still lived. Fires burned along the battlements, a vain attempt to drive the gloom away. Their small party found themselves slugging through a smooth, unbroken expanse of white that came halfway up their calves. The tents in the yard were half buried, sagging under the weight of the accumulation. The entrance to the crypts was in the older section of the castle, near the foot of the first keep, which had sat unused for hundreds of years. Ramsay had put it to the torch when he sacked Winterfell, and much of what had not burned had collapsed. Only a shell remained, one side open to the elements and filling up with snow. Rubble was strewn all about it, great chunks of shattered masonry, burned beams, broken gargoyles. The falling snow had covered almost all of it. But part of one gargoyle still poked above the drift, its grotesque face snarling sightless at the sky.
"This is where they found Bran when he fell."
Theon had been out hunting that day, riding with Lord Eddard and King Robert, with no hint of the dire news that awaited them back at the castle. He remembered Rob's face when they told him. No one had expected the broken boy to live.
"The gods could not kill Bran, no more than I could."
It was a strange thought, and stranger still to remember that Bran might still be alive.
"There,"
Theon pointed to where a snowbank had crept up the wall of the keep.
"Under there. Watch for broken stones."
It took Lady Dustin's men the better part of half an hour to uncover the entrance, shoveling through the snow and shifting rubble. When they did, the door was frozen shut. Her sergeant had to go find an axe before he could pull it open, hinges screaming, to reveal stone steps spiralling down into darkness.
"It's a long way down, my lady," Theon cautioned.
Lady Dustin was undeterred.
"Bear on the light."
The way was narrow and steep, the steps worn in the centre by centuries of feet. They went single file, the sergeant with the lantern, then Theon and Lady Dustin, her other man behind them. He had always thought of the crypts as cold, and so they seemed in summer, but now, as they descended, the air grew warmer. Not warm, never warm,
but warmer than above. Down here below the earth, it would seem the chill was constant, unchanging.
"The bride weeps," Lady Dustin said, as they made their way down, step by careful step. "Our little Lady Aria."
"Take care now, take care, take care." He put one hand on the wall. The shifting torchlight made the step seem to move beneath his feet.
As you say, my lady. Roos is not pleased. Tell your bastard that."
"He's not my bastard," he wanted to say, but another voice inside him said,
"He is, he is. Reek belongs to Ramsay, and Ramsay belongs to Reek. You must not forget your name." "Dressing her in grey and white serves no good if the girl is left to sub. The Freys may not care, but the Northmen, they fear the Dreadfort, but they love the Starks."
"Not you," said Theon.
"And not me," the Lady of Barrowton confessed. "But the rest, yes. Old Horsebane is only here because the Freys held the Great John captive. And do you imagine the Hornwood men had forgotten the bastard's last marriage, and how his lady wife was left to starve, chewing her own fingers? What do you think passes through their heads when they hear the new bride weeping? Valiant Ned's precious little girl."
"No," he thought, "she is not of Lord Eddard's blood. Her name is Jane. She is only a Stuart's daughter." He did not doubt that Lady Dustin suspected, but even so.
"Lady Arya's subs do us more harm than all of Lord Stannis's swords and spears. If the bastard means to remain Lord of Winterfell, he had best teach his wife to laugh." "My lady," Theon broke in, "here we are."
"The steps go further down," observed Lady Dustin.
"There are lower levels, older. The lowest level is partly collapsed, I hear. I've never been down there."
He pushed the door open and led them out into a long vaulted tunnel, where mighty granite pillars marched two by two into blackness. Lady Dustin's sergeant raised a lantern. Shadows slid and shifted. A small light in a great darkness. Theon had never felt comfortable in the crypts. He could feel the stone kings staring down at him with their stone eyes, stone fingers curled around the hilts of rusted longswords. None had any love for Ironborn. A familiar sense of dread filled him.
"So many," Lady Dustin said. "Do you know their names?"
"Once, but it was a long time ago." Theon pointed.
"The ones on this side were kings in the north. Turin was the last. The king who knelt?"
"Aye, my lady. After him, they were only lords.
Until the young wolf. Where is Ned Stark's tomb?"
"At the end. This way, my lady."
Their footsteps echoed through the vaults as they made their way between the rows of pillars. The stone eyes of the dead men seemed to follow them, and the eyes of their stone direwolves as well. The faces stirred faint memories. A few names came back to him, unbidden, whispered in the ghostly voice of Maester Luin. King Edric Snowbeard, who had ruled the North for 100 years. Brandon the Shipwright, who had sailed beyond the sunset. Theon Stark, the Hungry Wolf.
"My namesake."
Lord Beren Stark, who made common cause with Castle Rock to war against Dagon Greyjoy, Lord of Pike, in the days when the Seven Kingdoms were ruled in all but name by the bastard sorcerer men called Bloodraven.
"That king is missing his sword," Lady Dustin observed.
It was true. Theon did not recall which king it was, but the long sword he should have held was gone. Streaks of rust remained to show where it had been. The sight disquieted him. He had always heard that the iron in the sword kept the spirits of the dead locked within their tombs. If a sword was missing,
"There are ghosts in Winterfell, and I am one of them,"
They walked on. Barbary Dustin's face seemed to harden with every step.
She likes this place no more than I do.
Theon heard himself say,
My lady, why do you hate the Starks?
She studied him.
For the same reason you love them.
Theon stumbled.
Love them? I took this castle from them, my lady. I had Bran and Rickon put to death, mounted their heads on spikes. I rode south with Robb Stark, fought beside him at the Whispering Wood and River Run, returned to the Iron Islands as his envoy to treat with your own father. Barriton sent men with a young wolf as well. I gave them as few men as I dared, but I knew that I must needs give him some or risk the wrath of Winterfell. So I had my own eyes and ears in that host. They kept me well informed. I know who you are. I know what you are. Now answer my question. Why do you love the Starks?
Theon put a gloved hand against the pillar.
I wanted to be one of them. And never could. We have more in common than you know, my lord. But come.
Only a little farther on, three tombs were closely grouped together. That was where they halted.
Lord Rickard,
Lady Dustin observed, studying the central figure. The statue loomed above them, long-faced, bearded, solemn. He had the same stone eyes as the rest, but his looked sad.
He lacks a sword as well.
It was true.
Someone has been down here stealing swords. Brandon's is gone as well. He would hate that.
She pulled off her glove and touched his knee, pale flesh against dark stone.
Brandon loved his sword. He loved to hone it. I want it sharp enough to shave the hair from a woman's cunt, he used to say, and how he loved to use it. A bloody sword is a beautiful thing, he told me once.
You knew him, Theon said. The lantern light in her eyes made them seem as if they were afire.
Brandon was fostered at Barriton with old Lord Dustin, the father of the one I'd later wed. But he spent most of his time riding the Rills. He loved to ride. His little sister took after him in that. A pair of centaurs, those two. And my lord father was always pleased to play host to the heir to Winterfell. My father had great ambitions for House Risewell. He would have served up my maidenhead to any Stark who happened by. But there was no need. Brandon was never shy about taking what he wanted. I'm old now, a dried-up thing, too long a widow, but I still remember the look of my maiden's blood on his cock the night he claimed me. I think Brandon liked the sight as well. A bloody sword is a beautiful thing, yes. It hurt, but it was a sweet pain. The day I learned that Brandon was to marry Caitlin Tully, though, there was nothing sweet about that pain. He never wanted her. I promise you that. He told me so on our last night together. But Rickard Stark had great ambitions, too. Southron ambitions that would not be served by having his heir marry the daughter of one of his own vassals. Afterward, my father nursed some hope of wedding me to Brandon's brother, Eddard. But Caitlin Tully got that one as well. I was left with young Lord Dustin until Ned Stark took him from me. Robert's rebellion. Lord Dustin and I had not been married half a year when Robert rose and Ned Stark called his banners. I begged my husband not to go. He had kin he might have sent in his stead. An uncle famed for his prowess with an axe, a great uncle who had fought in the war of the Ninepenny Kings. But he was a man and full of pride. Nothing would serve but that he lead the Barriton levies himself. I gave him a horse the day he set out, a red stallion with a fiery mane,
the pride of my lord father's herds. My lord swore that he would ride him home when the war was done. Ned Stark returned the horse to me on his way back home to Winterfell. He told me that my lord had died an honourable death, that his body had been laid to rest beneath the red mountains of Dawn. He brought his sister's bones back north, though, and there she rests. But I promise you, Lord Eddard's bones will never rest beside hers. I mean to feed them to my dogs.
Theon did not understand.
His bones?
Her lips twisted. It was an ugly smile, a smile that reminded him of Ramsay's.
Caitlin Tully dispatched Lord Eddard's bones north, before the Red Wedding. But your iron uncle seized Moat Cailin and closed the way. I have been watching ever since. Should those bones ever emerge from the swamps, they will get no farther than Barriton.
She threw one last lingering look at the likeness of Eddard Stark.
We are done here.
The snowstorm was still raging when they emerged from the crypts. Lady Dustin was silent during their ascent. But when they stood beneath the ruins of the first keep again, she shivered and said,
"You would do well not to repeat anything I might have said down there. Is that understood?"
It was.
"Oh, my tongue, or lose it. Roos has trained you well."
She left him there. The King's Prize. The King's host departed Deepwood Knot by the light of a golden dawn, uncoiling from behind the log palisades like a long steel serpent emerging from its nest. The southern knights rode out in plate and mail, dinted and scarred by the battles they had fought, but still bright enough to glitter when they caught the rising sun. Faded and stained, torn and mended, their banners and surcoats still made a riot of colours amidst the winter wood. Azure and orange, red and green, purple and blue and gold, glimmering amongst bare brown trunks, grey-green pines and sentinels, drifts of dirty snow. Each knight had his squires, servants, and men-at-arms. Behind them came armourers, cooks, grooms, ranks of spearmen, axemen, archers, grizzled veterans of 100 battles, and green boys off to fight their first. Before them marched the clansmen from the hills, chiefs and champions astride shaggy garrons, their hirsute fighters trotting beside them, clad in furs and boiled leather and old mail. Some painted their faces brown and green and tied bundles of brush about them to hide amongst the trees. Back of the main column, the baggage train followed. Mules, horses, oxen, a mile of wains and carts laden with food, fodder, tents, and other provisions. Last, the rear guard, more knights in plate and mail, with a screening of outriders following half-hidden, to make certain no foe could steal up on them unawares. Asher Greyjoy rode in the baggage train, in a covered wain, with two huge iron-rim wheels, fettered at wrist and ankle, and watched over day and night by a she-bear who snored worse than any man. His Grace King Stannis was taking no chances on his prize escaping captivity. He meant to carry her to Winterfell to display her there in chains for the lords of the North to see. The Kraken's daughter, bound and broken, proof of his power. Trumpet saw the column on its way. Spear points shone in the light of the rising sun, and all along the verges the grass glistened with a morning frost. Between Deepwood Mott and Winterfell lay 100 leagues of forest, 300 miles, as the raven flies. 15 days, the knights told each other. "Robert would have done it in 10, Asher heard Lord Fell boasting. His grandsire had been slain by Robert at Summerhall. Somehow this had elevated his slayer to godlike prowess in the grandson's eyes.
"Robert would have been inside Winterfell a fortnight ago, thumbing his nose at Bolton from the battlements."
"Best not mention that to Stannis," suggested Justin Massey, "or he'll have us marching nights as well as days."
"This king lives in his brother's shadow," Asha thought.
Her ankle still gave a stab of pain whenever she tried to put her weight on it. Something was broken down inside, Asha did not doubt. The swelling had gone down at Deepwood, but the pain remained. A sprain would surely have healed by now. Her arms clacked every time she moved. The fetters chafed at her wrist and at her pride. But that was the cost of submission.
"No man has ever died from bending his knee," her father had once told her. "He who kneels may rise again, bleed in hand. He who will not kneel stays dead, stiff legs and all."
Balin Greyjoy had proved the truth of his own words when his first rebellion failed. The Kraken bent the knee to Stag and Direwolf, only to rise again when Robert Baratheon and Eddard Stark were dead. And so, at Deepwood, the Kraken's daughter had done the same when she was dumped before the king, bound and limping, though blessedly unraped, her ankle a blaze of pain.
"I yield, your grace. Do as you wish with me. I ask only that you spare my men."
Carl and Triss and the rest who had survived the Wolf's Wood were all she had to care about. Only 9 remained.
"We ragged 9,
Crumb named them. He was the worst wounded. Stannis had given her their lives, yet she sensed no true mercy in the man. He was determined beyond a doubt, nor did he lack for courage. Men said he was just, and if his was a harsh, hard-handed sort of justice, well, life on the Iron Islands had accustomed Asha Greyjoy to that. All the same, she could not like this king. Those deep-set blue eyes of his seemed always slitted in suspicion, cold fury boiling just below their surface. Her life meant little and less to him. She was only his hostage, a prize to show the North that he could vanquish the Ironborn. More fool him. Bringing down a woman was not like to awe any Northman, if she knew the breed, and her worth as a hostage was less than naught. Her uncle ruled the Iron Islands now, and the Crow's Eye would not care if she lived or died. It might matter some to the wretched ruin of a husband that Euron had inflicted upon her, but Eric Ironmaker did not have coin enough to ransom her. But there was no explaining such things to Stannis Baratheon. Her very womanhood seemed to offend him. Men from the Greenlands liked their women soft and sweet in silk, she knew, not clad in mail and leather, with a throwing axe in each hand. But her short acquaintance with the king at Deepwood Mott convinced her that he would have been no more fond of her in a gown. Even with Gorbert Glover's wife, the pious Lady Sibel, he had been correct and courteous, but plainly uncomfortable. This southern king seemed to be one of those men to whom women are another race, as strange and unfathomable as giants and grumpkins and the children of the forest. The she-bear made him grind his teeth as well. There was only one woman that Stannis listened to, and he had left her on the wall.
"Though I would sooner she was with us," confessed Sir Justin Massey, the fair-haired knight who commanded the baggage train. "The last time we went into battle without Lady Melisandre was the Blackwater, when Lord Renly's Shade came down upon us and drove half our host into the bay."
"The last time," Asha said, "was this sorceress at Deepwood Mott? I did not see her."
"Hardly a battle," Sir Justin said, smiling.
Your Iron Man fought bravely, my lady, but we had many times your numbers, and we took you unawares. Winterfell will know...